back with the podcast. We have to do this more often. I promise you I will. This is Greg Kelly. This is the Greg Kelly Podcast. So how is life? I feel great, if not a little bit fat. I went a little bit bananas with free Fritos that were all over my personal workspace. But that's fine. Moving on, I started to swim. I'm actually swimming a half hour every day. How's that going to work out for me? I don't know, but so far it's very, what the hell is it? Hardest part is getting in the cold pool. Once you're in for about 30 seconds, you're fine. And I don't know. I hope I get all cut up like those guys you see on TV. Something tells me that's, you probably have to swim 9 hours a day to do it. I'm in there for a half hour. Look, today I'm really happy to be speaking with Rick Grenell. Rick was the ambassador to Germany under Donald Trump. He was the director of national intelligence under Donald Trump. He's a very good friend of the president, and he also is just an all-around expert. Spent many years working for the State Department, the United Nations. He understands the world the way it really works, like few people do out there. He's really just a nice person, and he's open, he's interesting, and I think he's very, very fair. And let's see here, he's only 57 years old, so stay tuned. I could totally see this guy being president someday. Now, I wish I had the note handy. I wish I had it handy. He wrote Donald Trump a beautiful note on New Year's Eve a couple of years ago, and Donald Trump put it in his big coffee table book, Letters to Trump. We're going to talk about that during this conversation that we're about to have. It's a two-parter, by the way. All of his answers are interesting, very, very substantive, but there's some things I did not get to talk to him about, so we will be doing this again, Rick Grenell and I. And by the way, if Trump wins, very conceivably, he could be the next Secretary of State, something along those lines. He's one of Donald Trump's trusted lieutenants, and more than just trustworthy, he brings so much expertise and knowledge and experience to the table. You know, sometimes you don't have that, actually, in your trusted people. They can help you get elected, but they can't help you govern. I think Rick Grenell is poised to help him do both amazingly well. First, I have to thank our great sponsor, D'Espresso Liber. They are back with us. It's a great coffee. And ever since the American Revolution, drinking coffee has actually been declared at times an act of patriotism. And especially during these times, we cannot forget what makes us uniquely American. Hard work, self-determination, individual liberty, and freedom doesn't brew itself. That's what they like to say at D'Espresso Liber, and that's why I like to say it as well. D'Espresso Liber was actually founded by a Green Beret about a decade ago, and he developed a dedication to crafting outstanding brews after multiple overseas deployments. D'Espresso Liber coffee is 100% Arabica coffee, sourced from the finest coffee farms from around the world, and is roasted fresh in-house once they receive your order. The D'Espresso Liber experience starts from the moment you receive the package. It's really kind of nifty how it comes. I'm going to keep it a surprise. You got to see it and feel it. Open the package and smell it. It is so, well, delicious. I'm not an expert in coffee, but I do love this D'Espresso Liber so much. It's out of this world, tasty, full-bodied, smooth, and it gives me a real jumpstart to my day. It's rich in flavor and American values. D'Espresso Liber coffee. It encourages all of us to sit down together and unite with fellow patriots to celebrate our God-given rights. So just visit D'EspressoLiber.com. That's D-E, then the word espresso, E-S-P-R-E-S-S-O, Liber, L-I-B-E-R, like liberty, and we put a little French twist on it, Liber, D'EspressoLiber.com. One more time, D-E-E-S-P-R-E-S-S-O-L-I-B-E-R. DEspressoLiber.com. Check it out, and they'll get it out to you right away. You will thoroughly, thoroughly enjoy it. And thank you for your support. And now my conversation with Rick Grinnell, total superstar, an all-around great guy with a big, big future. Thank you, Rick Grinnell. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me, Greg.
Well, Rick, big admirer, and you're a very intriguing guy. You know, you wrote the most beautiful note to Donald Trump that he put in his recent book. Do you remember, what is it about Donald Trump that appeals to you so much?
Well, first of all, I do remember that letter, and I wrote it on New Year's Eve. And, you know, we all kind of go through a little nostalgia on New Year's Eve. You think backwards and you think forward. You think about, you know, what's been happening over the last year, and you start to think about wishes for the future. And I wrote him a letter because I was thinking about the disaster that our country was in. Just if you could literally do the exact opposite of what a president has done or was doing, it would be from Trump to Biden. I mean, we had an amazing economy, gas prices, food prices, no wars. And, you know, Greg, the worst part about this is that the opposite message was sent to the American people through the media. And you know, I know all these reporters. I've worked in politics for so long that I know every one of these reporters. And I know that they have a bias. They have a favorite. They have a attitude that they are going to help the Democrats. And I wrote this letter to President Trump because he was up against the media in Washington, D.C. that absolutely did not play fair and wanted to crush him, and they tried. And yet his successes were so amazing that on New Year's Eve, I was thinking how grateful I am for somebody like President Trump who can take all these hits, and when it's so obvious that he was the best president. And, you know, look, I worked for President H.W. Bush and President Bush and nominee John McCain and nominee, you know, Mitt Romney. I've done 6 presidential races. I'm no, you know, newbie to all of this, but, you know, I got to say, the guy that I worked for at the time that I was, you know, excited to work for, George W. Bush, you know, he I remember back then people marching against him in the streets of every major city in America, marching to say that he was a war criminal, and that he and Dick Cheney should go in front of the Hague. And for them to not understand how potent the media is, how wrong the media is, how much they shill for the Democratic Party, and to somehow abandon Donald Trump and believe all of this media nonsense for Romney and McCain and the Bushes to do that, to me, is unbelievable. You know, George W. Bush, by the New York Times standard in the media in Washington, D.C., was supposed to be a war criminal in front of the Hague. And somehow now they just, you know, they let it go. And you know, his daughter gets to be on NBC every morning pretending like they weren't a part of that. I think that short-term memory is one of the things that also made me realize that Donald Trump was given such a terrible raw deal. I've seen this up firsthand that, you know, I wrote this letter to thank him and to also encourage him that he can come back. And when he does, he's going to once again prove to them just how great of a negotiator and dealer he is for the American people.
Wow. couple things there. The media, real quick. I totally agree with you. I can't believe what we're seeing, what they say. But the last thing you mentioned about the Bushes, they've been rehabilitated, and the Cheneys, they've been rehabilitated. Do you see it as I do? Like, because they've come out against Trump, all else is forgiven. I mean, it was 2018 that movie came out. Yeah. It was called Vice, I think, and it really depicted the Cheneys as war criminals and war profiteers. And now Liz Cheney is the darling of the establishment. I mean, and even the Democrat Party.
And she's working against Republicans. I don't understand how these people do not see it. They were burned by this crowd in Washington, D.C. And, you know, to me, the only thing I can compare it to is just people who are so desperate to be liked by the other side that they're willing to abandon their own principles in order to be celebrated by the other side. But shame on the Bushes. Honestly, again, Greg, I worked for them, and I've been very good over the last years to not criticize the people that I worked for. But it's gotten to be too much for me to watch the hypocrisy of the Bush crowd, who clearly does not remember that they were all considered war criminals. And look, let me also say to, you know, my friend at the time, Nicole Wallace, who was inside the White House as the communications director for George Bush, when George Bush tried to change the Constitution of the United States to ban gay marriage. And I, Greg, as you know, I'm gay, and I worked for Bush at the time. And I went to the White House officials and said, I can't be a part of this. This is wrong, and I don't want to be a part of this. I was told by the very people now who hate Donald Trump that George Bush was doing this, and that Dick Cheney was going to be against it, and that I could speak out against it and still have my job. They recognized that this was an issue that people could come out against if you were in the administration, and it was going to be okay, that there wasn't going to be a loyalty test. And so I did. I came out against it, and I didn't get fired from my job. But my point in saying this is that, you know, one of the enforcers was Nicole Wallace. She was one of the people that, if you weren't loyal to the George Bush way, you would be penalized. Now, on this issue, they gave a little bit of a reprieve, but on other issues, they didn't. And I haven't heard I like Nicole. She's been a friend of mine. I haven't seen her in years, but I don't see the flip-flop that she did. I've never heard why she flip-flopped, why she's allowed to, why she gets a show on MSNBC pushing all of these left-wing ideas. Again, this is very typical for politics to be able to survive and thrive from the other side, be accepted by the other side, if you're mean to Donald Trump.
She exemplifies a lot of what's wrong with everything. Politicians, she's a target of mine because she, her hypocrisy or whatever the hell's going on there, offends me. I show pictures of her around Dan Bartlett, around Bush, where quite frankly, flirtation seemed to be one of her tools to ingratiate herself with men in power, and now she is stricken by the Dobbs decision. And Roe v. Wade being thrown out. And but my theory is just briefly on her. I think she knows everything she has to the Bushes. The Bushes hate Trump.
Absolutely true.
Right. So she
absolutely
can go
true.
All in anti-Trump. And it also, everybody forgets the Iraq war that she helped sell. And there's basically most people who go to Washington are more interested in money and power and influence than they are principles. And I think she kind of exemplifies all of that. Fair enough.
Well, here is what's interesting is that, as somebody who worked again for six presidential races, a lot of the the typical, what we would call rhinos today, you know, I've worked for a lot of them. I saw the error of the ways of pushing the war in Iraq. I was really outraged that people weren't admitting the mistakes and the intelligence failures. But the irony of this whole thing is that I am criticized for being a sycophant to Donald Trump, and somehow the criticism is you're benefiting from your relationship with Donald Trump, so you're the one who's just doing whatever he has to do to get ahead. And the irony is that it actually is not helpful in terms of your career with these rhinos and others to be out front with Donald Trump. It's actually, you get rewarded by the Washington crowd and the media if you're anti-Donald Trump. And so what they accuse me of doing, they're doing. You know, all of these people who have a much easier road with the national media because they've flipped. That's what's, you know, so ironic about it. But, you know, for me, I really honestly, even though we're talking about this, at the end of the day, I've never spoken about this because I really don't care. My life is not in Washington, D.C. I don't need Washington, D.C. types to like me. Matter of fact, I would be nervous if they did, thinking, what did I do differently and wrong? It's just a sense of, how hypocritical politics is, and how I want people to see the hypocrisy and see that the criticisms that they're doing of Donald Trump are just not fair.
And so immature. It's like right out of the high school cafeteria and cool kids and staying in. That's why I think, there's a real bitchy quality to it all. Can I ask you this finally on the media stuff? Are you concerned that, look, you and I and a lot of other people, you know, we dismiss the mainstream media. And the hardcore on the other side, you know, they love MSNBC, but there is the so-called middle or the apolitical kind of just drifting around. And I do believe that they are impacted by mainstream media coverage. And I've had some shocking examples of it this weekend. People just, you know, oh, well, Donald Trump, you know, he raped that woman. Oh, he's an insurrectionist. And these are not political people. These are people who just, you know, go about their lives. And if you don't seek out alternative voices or conservative media, you're going to kind of be pushed by that stuff. I see that as it's a real worry I have. Do you share it? Does that make sense?
Yeah. I don't share it too much because just a couple of practical things. One, I don't know anybody outside of the, DC newsrooms and political circles that pay for the New York Times, paywall. Or the LA Times, or, you know, the Washington Post. I just don't see people paying for news anymore. It's just, you know, a matter of fact, somebody sent me two articles today, one from the Washington Post and one from the New York Times. And I wrote them both back and said, you know, I don't pay for these, so I can't even read them. And they're always shocked because I'm not engaging in whatever this person is saying. But I think that there's first of all, young people, like all of my nephews and nieces who are in their 20s and 30s, none of them even have cable, Greg. None of them. They don't watch what older people watch. This is a real crisis for media companies because young people, you know, they're getting their news from Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter, and that's, you know, to me, the reason why they kicked Donald Trump off Twitter was because he was successfully going around the editors at the New York Times. People didn't need to read the stories in the New York Times. They could get the information straight from Donald Trump. And when you go around the filter gets really upset. And so they had to crack down on him because he was doing successfully, you know, reaching the public. So I think every year it's getting worse for them because as people come of age and get older, they're just, this next generation is just not using cable or print media And their power is diminishing. So I'm really encouraged.
Yeah, this is everything is true that you said, but I do remember 20 years ago they were saying kind of like the young people are getting their news from The Daily Show, and we got to worry about that. I've heard this for a while. I mean, look, selfishly, I kind of wanted to stick around for a little bit longer. Let me ask you this. You're an ambassador to Germany from the United States. Actually, what was your official title? Forgive me.
U.S. ambassador.
U.S. ambassador to, what is it called? The Republic of Germany? The Dem what is it?
Yes, to the Republic of Germany. Yep.
And how did you get that job?
It's a really interesting story. And I've never talked about this too much because, frankly, you don't have time on a 6-minute interview. But I worked on the 2015, 2016 Trump campaign. And when it was all said and done, and the president won, Donald Trump won, and we were doing the transition, I knew, I'd worked at the UN for 8 years. I'd been the top political and spokesperson at the US mission to the UN, top American. And so I worked with four different ambassadors. I saw what it was like to be an ambassador. I knew the importance of it, the responsibilities. And I wanted to be an ambassador. And a lot of people were trying to get me to come into the White House in that first term. And when I told, President Trump that I wanted to be an ambassador and not work at the White House, I think there was a little bit of a, wait a minute, you don't want to be at the White House? And it panned out to where I thought about the UN job in the beginning. President Trump dissuaded me, said, I talked more about NATO than the UN during the campaign, and why don't you be US ambassador to NATO? So I was going down that road. And if you go back, there's like a whole bunch of media attention that speculating I was about to be announced as US ambassador to NATO. And right around that time, Rex Tillerson was hired as the Secretary of State. And he didn't want me to be US ambassador to NATO. And there was a little bit of a crash. Tillerson said, I don't want this guy. And the president had said, no, Rick is going to do this. Tillerson kept putting up a fight. And I got a call saying from somebody very high up at the White House. Saying, look, the president says if you want to be U.S. ambassador to NATO, you can be, and that we will just tell the Secretary of State that. But can I? This person said, can I send you a list of countries that are still available if you want to be a team player and go somewhere else instead? Look at this list. So they gave me a list of about 9 countries. And when I saw that Germany was on there, I said, you know what? I'd be happy to do Germany instead of NATO. I'll be a team player. And I thought it was a better fit anyway. And originally didn't really know that it was open, and the president kind of said he wanted me at NATO. And by the way, I will say this, there was a period, Greg, that when I was going to be US ambassador to NATO, I was friends with John McCain. I had worked on his presidential race and I knew him. And he and I were talking about the fact that I was going to NATO. He was very supportive, probably at the time, maybe the only Trump, nominee that he was supportive of, and even was going to introduce me to the Senate when I was going to go up for US Ambassador to NATO. And then he got sick. And it, you know, he when ultimately I switched and I became the nominee for Germany, by the time I came up for a vote, he, I don't remember the exact, he didn't get to vote for me because he was either sick and at home. I don't remember the exact timing, but he wasn't able to vote. Maybe he had passed. I can't even remember the timing, but I remember thinking that I was hoping that he would vote for me or even introduce me, and he wasn't able to. I say that because, you know, I've had a long history on foreign policy, and I think there's a lot of people that knew me as a thoughtful, intellectual somebody who would push back and not just take the line. And I think that's what Donald Trump likes. He likes people who have a good basis and who can, you know, push on these issues. So we talked a lot. The president and I talked a lot about Germany and what the job was. And I got very excited about Germany and I ended up going there. And I did a lot of specific things that the president asked me to do in Europe. And, you know, I had a great time until he called me back.
Right, right. You know, that process you just kind of outlined, to me from the outside, it seems a lot of folks don't know that that happens. I'm aware that that has happened, you know, like the president wants you at NATO and then some guy, you know, Rex Tillerson, although he is the incoming Secretary of State, doesn't want it. And that there's this whole give and take. And
yeah,
just because you're the president elected the United States, you know, doesn't mean you get what you want. And
well, I think let's be clear. He could have.
He could have, but there is this
president could have. The president was willing to say, just send Rick to NATO. But there's so many jobs. Remember, in this transition period, Greg, he's looking at, you know, hundreds of jobs and appointments. And some people don't want certain things. Some people do. A lot of people get disappointed that they don't get their first choice. And the president's not intimately involved in every single one of these negotiations. But on the ones that he cares about, he absolutely would say, you know, let's make this happen. With me, I think he was interested in saying, talk to Rick, see what he wants, see if he's willing. And if he absolutely still wants NATO, then he's going to NATO. And that was the conversation that that I had had.
Yeah. It just, you know, I mean, you will forget about you for a second in the ambassador job. Like, I think it is shockingly, people would be shocked at how it is not based on the merits often, right? You know, somebody, it's just, it becomes very, I guess, political.
Political
yeah. With like a small p. I mean, well, it always has a small p, but political in a kind of, not a shallow way, but I don't know.
It's a negotiation sometimes.
Your ambassador to Germany, how did you like that? Oh, first thing, before I ask you how you like that job, how much leeway do you have? I mean, like, are you being dictated to by by either the president or the Secretary of State? Are you on a tight leash, or do you have a fair amount of latitude?
That's such a great question. You'll be shocked to know the answer is somewhere in the middle, depending on the day and depending on the person. look, I think it's an imperative that the ambassadors represent the president and what the president wanted. I mean, here's the person who campaigned for 2 years trying to be the people's person. And so you're articulating how you, what you believe on every single issue. It's very important that the ambassadors don't have this ego that they do their own thing. But it's also just as important to not be the one that's asking for direction on every particular issue. I think you have to understand what America First is. You have to, you know, be able to change when there is a different direction given to you. For me, you know, I knew President Trump, his worldview, and could use that to assume whatever the specific policy was. Now, the State Department and the bureaucrats, and certainly the Secretary of State, they try as much as possible to dictate to you, though, you're not supposed to make a move without, you know, us having the Deputy Assistant Secretary for European Affairs sign off. And just because I've worked at the State Department for 12 years, I tend to understand just how the bureaucrats try to push their agenda onto the system. So there were many times that I would push back on the bureaucracy and say, that's not what the president would do. That's not what he thinks. That's not the policy of America First. And so I was the one challenging. At first, that didn't go over very well. Let me be very diplomatic and say, I don't think I was Mike Pompeo's favorite ambassador. I think that's a nice diplomatic way to say it. I hope I was Donald Trump's favorite ambassador because I every day thought about him and representing him because he was the one who campaigned throughout America, throughout every issue, on every issue, to articulate what he believed on these issues, and the American people voted for him. And so I think that's a more democratic process than the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State telling me what I should do on a certain issue.
It is a little bit daunting to think, though, about what it would be like for somebody not like you, say a financier or somebody who's being rewarded with a big ambassadorship, because they would be totally reliant on the system.
Yes. And I will tell you, within the ambassador pool, especially for Europe, I took phone calls from ambassadors all the time who were new to the State Department that would say, "Help me out here. What am I supposed to do? This is, this person is saying this, and I don't believe this is the right thing to do." And so I was the big champion of pushing back and telling our ambassadors, "The president appointed you. You don't have to call the president on this issue and say, 'How do you feel?' But you've got a good gut. You were appointed here. You know what it means to be America first." And so sometimes you have to be a leader and push back on the State Department because you are more in touch with what President Trump would want than they are. And I never allowed the title to get in the way of the goal because for me, I didn't care if you were the assistant secretary for whatever, just because you had a big fancy title, I was always checking to make sure that you were doing the America First policy. And if I didn't think that you were, then I would call you up and have that conversation and say, "Look, this is where I disagree." I'm a very strong personality, but I'm also a nice guy. Like, I'm not going to be rude to anyone, but let's have a conversation, and you better know your stuff because these issues matter.
You mentioned the title, though. To me, I learned about this in the Marine Corps, though. My understanding is if you're an ambassador, which is one hell of a title, I mean, and it's so much more prestigious than, say, being an assistant secretary. But I was shocked to learn, and correct me if I'm wrong, that and I think you just kind of said this, an assistant secretary of state for whatever outranks an ambassador. Is that true?
No, it doesn't.
What
No,
does
the ambassador definitely within your country is the top person. If technically, it even before the vice president. If the vice president came to Germany, within that country, that ambassador is the president's top person, and the protocol is that that is the top
Yeah.
in terms of protocol, that's the top seat.
But you had a boss. I mean, to the extent that you had a boss on paper, I'm talking about, not like soft or
Yeah.
informal.
On paper, the boss is the Secretary of State.
Okay. Can I ask you, what did you spend most of your time doing as ambassador? Like, looking back, your most days were spent doing what, or is it just a dynamic job and everything is different every each day?
As you know, Greg, I was very hands-on. I woke up early, went into the office, had a senior staff meeting. I included all sorts of individuals from the embassy. The embassy is very large. There's five consulates. So Germany is one of the biggest jobs that there is in the diplomatic corps. And so I was very specific with the team. These are our goals. And so I spent most of my day benchmarking our entire embassy as to are we achieving our goals. I'll give you an example. One of our goals was to get the German government to ban Hezbollah, a terrorist organization. The challenge that I knew through my years at the UN is that the Europeans, through Brussels and through the EU system in Brussels, Belgium, they had not banned Hezbollah as a terrorist organization. They had a nuanced view that some people were terrorists, but not the whole organization. And so Hezbollah is not banned in Europe. And when I went to Chancellor Merkel and said, look, you're the largest economy in Europe, the Germans, this stuff matters. You need to ban Hezbollah and be the leader in Europe. And, you know, her first reaction was, oh, no, we are part of the EU. We can't do anything unless the EU does something, go to Brussels. So I went to Brussels and had, you know, committee meetings about this and quickly determined that there was no possible way that was happening in Brussels. So I went back to the Germans and they said, you know, no, we can't do this. And then came up with some excuse, you know, legally it wasn't appropriate, that they didn't have the right laws. So with my team, we spent a lot of time, you know, whack-a-mole trying to figure out how to get this done. We ended up hiring a German lawyer to write a paper, a legal document explaining how the German law could be used to ban Hezbollah. And I took it into the National Security Advisor, who was a lawyer himself. And I said, Jan, his name is Jan Hecker. I said, Jan, here's this paper. Outlining how you can ban Hezbollah. And I remember giving him this paper and him briefly looking at it. And I had a Foreign Service officer with me, a woman actually, who I called the hammer, because she was one of the best people ever with negotiations. But she was a very attractive blonde mom, and just when you looked at her, you didn't think fierce. But she was like a hammer. So I nicknamed her the hammer, and she always laughed about that. And she was with me, and Jan would glance at the paper, and I remember distinctly him saying, was this written by an American? And I said, no, sir. I know that you wouldn't accept an American legal scholar doing this. It had to be a German. And he said, it's very good. And let me dig into it. And he took a couple of days, called back, and he said, this is a great pathway. We're going to do it. We're going to ban Hezbollah. And what I learned in that moment was, one, don't give up. And two, work within your country to understand their limitations. The Germans are very legally driven, and they needed a path. And they couldn't see the path, and we got them the path. And so we ended up getting the entire team at the U.S. Embassy, I give credit to, we banned Hezbollah in Germany, and Hezbollah is still banned in Germany today, and it's being used now to really go after Hamas. And so it was one of a very proud moment for us. But we had to do that, Greg. Every single day we had to have our senior staff meeting. That was one of the things that we would talk about. And I tried to give the team five or six very specific goals. And when we achieved a couple of them, then I issued another five or six goals. And the goals weren't things like, oh, improve German-American relations, but they were very specific. We have to ban Hezbollah. We have to shut down this youth hostel that the North Koreans were operating in Berlin. That was another one. We had to stop the flow of money going to Iran. We had an airline, an Iranian airline, Mahan Air, operating from Tehran into Germany, into multiple cities in Germany every week. And that was unacceptable to me. And so we shut down Mahan Air, and that took a lot as well. But, you know, eventually, if you stay focused on your goal and you work with your team, you can get a lot of this done. And we did. We got a lot done.
I love it. I love the specificity. I mean, what a great approach. Now, you mentioned, though, you had a big team at the German embassy, you know, very well staffed. What about resistance to your agenda? I mean, you know, you hear about it all the time, like the career people working against the political people. And I would, but I sense that you didn't have much of that, maybe because you knew that world so well. But can you talk about that?
Yeah, I do. I know that world really well. I know foreign service officers. There are a lot of foreign service officers who will salute and salute whoever's president and implement the policies whether they believe it or not. There are definitely foreign service officers with their own agenda, both on the left and the right, who are not going to listen to the president, who are going to ignore the president's policies and do their own thing. And those are the people who I think are very dangerous. Within our embassy in Germany, and I would even include the bureaucrats, the career officials at DNI when I went there. You know when people have a belief other than your own. So I knew if you've got a personality and you know you're an open person and you're a nice person and you're personable. You get to know somebody and you know their political beliefs. And so I actually really respected the people who were Democrats and who could talk to me about politics and represent their side and their candidate and do it in a fun, jovial, open way. I respected them so much more because they felt comfortable enough to say, you know, I voted for Joe Biden. Or I voted for Hillary Clinton. I didn't vote for Donald Trump. But then they would also say things like, I really like this policy from Trump. You know, they were much more of an honest person that you could trust. And so I worked very closely with partisan Democrats who I trusted, who I knew, Greg, would implement the president's policies because they were people who were willing to be open and honest, and their political beliefs they were unashamed of because they knew their professionalism, if that makes sense. It was the people that were secretive that I distrusted. And the ones who, you know, were phonies, of course, they would fake it and you could read them, and over time they would out themselves. I know enough foreign service officers who voted left, right, and center, and who I don't care who they voted for because I trust them to implement the president's policies. And in many ways, I'll be honest, some of my top people at the embassy in Berlin who were hardcore Democrats became very important to our success because they were willing to say this was a good policy and they could get behind it and they gave it a lot of credibility. Let me give you one example. After I was gone as ambassador, there was a panel discussion at the State Department with some political people. And in the State Department, if you're a political officer, it doesn't mean politics, it means, you know, the party. It's
Political
kind of
affairs in
the
another country or something. I get
political
it. Right,
affairs,
right.
exactly. And in this panel discussion, one of the people who was asking the questions implied, like, "Oh, you must have had a terrible time in Germany because you work with Ambassador Grinnell. Tell us about that experience." And this person, in front of all of these people, who was a known Democrat, said, I have to be honest with you, it was one of my best experiences in the Foreign Service to work for Ambassador Grinnell. He was very accessible. He was very open. He was funny and approachable and nice, but absolutely held us to an extreme goal. And we had to meet that goal. And every day we met. And you know, this woman who now has a very senior job in the Foreign Service was really honest about her experience. And I appreciated that. And I didn't have any leaks in Germany. I didn't have any leaks against me. I know the system, and you know, look, I'm not naive enough to think that that's ever going to happen again. But I say all that to say I do trust many people in the Foreign Service and know them very well, and will rely on the Foreign Service if I ever go back into government.
Do you think that the people around the world, and actually people in the State Department, people in general, Donald Trump is far more sophisticated, nuanced, savvy, and like, I guess the word might be continental, especially with Europe. I mean, and I think he is a guy, you know, let's face it, he's been married to two different European women. I mean, he understands the world and he understands world leaders in a way that I don't think anybody outside of all this really understands. He gets them and they get him. This is the kind of person that automatically commands respect. And not only just because it's Donald Trump or the president, I mean, like, he, fill in the blank here for me, I feel like he understands sophisticated, smart people.
It's a real world experience. And, you know, Donald Trump, as a businessman, as the outsider of government, you know, remember, he was smart enough as a businessman to give contributions to both the left and the right. He gave a lot of money to Schumer and to Hillary when he was a real estate developer in New York, because they were the senators there. He's very common sense driven. And his negotiations on behalf of the American people were not partisan. Matter of fact, Greg, I actually think these no labels people should be embracing Donald Trump. Who else is criticizing Chuck Schumer and Mitch McConnell? No one. You usually have a president who only criticizes one side, the other side. Donald Trump is willing to criticize the Republicans when they are swampy. And he's fighting for the American people. The no labels people are shameful. They're like the Nobel Prize Committee people. They've ruined their brand because they're not seeing what's right in front of them. The no labels people should be embracing Donald Trump because he is critical of both Republicans and Democrats. And I think that there are many in Europe. First of all, if you know Europe like I do, they're going through a crisis. Look at the leaders right now who are rising to the top are all conservatives. It's giving Western Europe, you know, heart attacks. They cannot believe that Donald Trump could come back in Western Europe, where the rest of Europe is really excited. Eastern Europe couldn't be more excited to have Donald Trump. The Balkan leaders love Donald Trump. Middle East leaders want him back. Asian leaders want him back. But the New York Times does this whole thing where it's just constantly checking in with France, Germany, and the elites in the UK, and maybe, you know, the Netherlands, and they come up with this, oh, Europe hates them. Look, the EU is in deep trouble because they can't get their act together. They're terrible on immigration. And let's be honest, they lost a member. They lost the UK because of their immigration policy. And they still aren't paying their NATO bills. And I see, you know, the latest freak out from Western Europe is that if Donald Trump comes back, NATO may be on the chopping block. You know, my attitude is you know that you're supposed to pay your 2% obligations. You committed to do this in 2014. We're about to be in 2024, 10 years later, and you're still not paying your 2%. Where do you think the problem is? It lies with them. They are not putting the emphasis on NATO, and shame on them for making the American taxpayer for 10 years cover for their broken promises. And I think that's what Donald Trump understands, is the common sense approach to Europe. And by the way, I'll finish with this, Greg. There are a whole bunch of people, a whole bunch of Europeans, even in Western Europe, that absolutely love Donald Trump's emphasis on common sense, on common sense issues. They support him. And we see the debate going on in Germany, the debate going on in France, and these people do not have a hold on their elitist policies. They are being undermined in their own country.
A lot more to talk to Rick Grinnell about. We are going to be having another conversation in the days ahead and bringing that back to you. I hope you enjoy this format. I love it. I am a very curious person, and I understand this you would not do this on television. Number one, you don't have the time. And number two, it's kind of indulgent, really, you know, for me to kind of take this kind of time from somebody. But one of the things that I think works about podcasts is that a lot of people aren't having conversations anymore. You know, you don't have conversations. And I miss that. And it's one of the reasons why I like listening to podcasts. I like listening to conversations. And I hope this inspires you to maybe have more conversations. So think about that, if you will. And I thank you for listening to this conversation. And I thank you also for checking out D'Espresso Le Bear Coffee. Great, great stuff. Great Christmas gift or whatever occasion that you're thinking of. D'EspressoLeBear.com is where you go. Remember, extremely high quality coffee. And this company was founded by a Green Beret. So it's veteran owned and it's family run, a small business whose brew tastes as good as it will make you feel. All right. Freedom doesn't brew itself. Remember that. And go to D'EspressoLeBear.com. D-E, Espresso, LeBear, LIBER.com. So it's D'EspressoLeBear.com. D'EspressoLeBear.com. We thank you, D'EspressoLeBear, and I thank you for listening. To be continued.